The Lakers took a 21-point lead in the first quarter, were up by 18 at the half, and were still ahead 70-50 with 6 minutes to go in the third. You don't come back from a deficit that big, not in the playoffs, and especially not on the road. Doc used to tell us, whenever we were down by 20, let's get it under 10, and we will turn it into a game. The other team, he said, would begin to feel the pressure and make mistakes. We got it under 10 all right, and it took only 4 minutes. After Paul completed a three-point play, the score was 73-64. We had gone 5 of 6 from the field. The Lakers were just 1 of 6. Scoring the final 10 points of the quarter, we trailed by just 2 going into the fourth. Game on. I knew one thing. No way was I coming out. Normally, Doc gives me a breather with about 5 minutes to go in the first quarter until early in the second. No breathers tonight. We couldn't afford to fall any further behind. Yes, I was exhausted. In addition to running around screens to get my own shot, I guarded Kobe. Every timeout felt like the 60 seconds between rounds of a heavyweight championship bout. Get me the Gatorade, Gus. Put a towel on my head. Don't forget the mouth guard. Now send me out there for another round. Ding. If you need to come out, let me know, Doc said during a timeout in the fourth. No, I'm okay, I told him. I got you. Good, he said, because I need you to stay in. A lot of my energy came from Shannon, my mom, and a few of the other wives and family members rooting for us behind the bench. Keep going, they said. You guys got it. With just under 5 minutes to go, we went on an 8-0 run to assume a 5-point lead. We were still ahead by 3 with 40 seconds left and had possession. One more basket just might do it. The ball was in my hands near half court. Sasha on me. He and I had been going at each other for the whole series. He didn't play dirty like Bruce Bowen or scratch me like Rip Hamilton. Sasha flopped, which I had zero respect for. Stop crying, I told him whenever he complained to the officials. He didn't stop. The shot clock was winding down. At this point, a lot of people probably assumed I would wait until the very end and launch a 3. I had another idea. To remind people I could go to the hoop as well as anyone. I dribbled toward the top of the key, and there was plenty of room to maneuver. No help was coming. No screen for a pick and roll. Just Sasha and me. One quick move to the right, and I was by him just as I drew it up in my head. Gasol tried to stop me, but he was too late. I laid it in off the glass with my left hand. The lead was 5. The game was over. I couldn't believe it. We had really done it. We had come from 24 points down on their floor. The fans were stunned. Our guys were ecstatic. When I got to the locker room, however, I didn't feel like celebrating. I felt like collapsing. I played hard game after game for 18 seasons, but this was the only game that, when the buzzer sounded, I had absolutely nothing left to give. It wasn't because I played the full 48 minutes, although I can't recall doing that before. It was because of everything in my career and life that had led me to that moment. Little did I know that a much tougher challenge was yet to come. And that it would have nothing to do with basketball. The whole week, our son Walker, who was 17 months old, wasn't himself. Based on his symptoms of throwing up and fatigue, we figured he had the flu. So we had a friend stay with him in the hotel on the night of Game 4. He didn't get any better. 2 days later, in the middle of the night, Shannon took him to a doctor who was on staff at the hotel. It looks like a virus, the doctor said. Maybe food poisoning. But to be safe, he told her, go to the hospital and don't leave without a blood test. Someone at the hospital didn't think he needed a blood test, but no one is more determined than Shannon. Thank God. 20 minutes later, the attending physician, white as a ghost, told her the news. Your son has type 1 diabetes, and if he doesn't get insulin soon, you're going to lose him. I was in my room, the players and their wives stayed at separate hotels, when she called. I'd heard of diabetes before, but only on those commercials you see on daytime TV. I knew nothing of what it does to a person, not to mention a little kid. "Do you want me to come right now?" I asked. "No," Shannon said. "Go play your game. But when it's over, get your ass over here. I need you." I got off the phone and went downstairs to the ballroom for the walkthrough we have before every game, where Doc goes over the sets and plays we're likely to run. We usually have it at the arena where we'll be playing, but our hotel in Beverly Hills was a long drive from Staples. No sense in going back and forth. I always paid close attention in walkthroughs, never knowing when I might see something in our spacing that could make a difference. Not this walkthrough. My mind was on Walker and diabetes, on a future Shannon and I could never have imagined. I prided myself on being prepared for every scenario. But how did one prepare for this? I didn't say a word to anybody until I arrived at Staples and spoke to Doc. He needed to know I wouldn't be my normal self. How could I be? "I'm so sorry to hear that," he said. "We will get some people who can help you guys out. Your boy will be all right." So I played, although not particularly well, as you might expect, hitting 4 of 13 in a 103-98 loss. The game is a blur to me. All I remember is looking over at my mother and a few friends every chance I could. "Walker will be okay," they assured me. Would he? I never left an arena as fast as I did that night, and I didn't care if the writers thought I was skipping out because we lost. I couldn't wait to see my son. He was the only person who mattered. There was so much to learn about the disease, how to give Walker the insulin, how to monitor his blood sugar count, how to set up his diet, how to keep him alive. One decision we had to make right away was what to tell people, if anything. Everybody, our family, friends, agents, wanted us to keep the matter private. Shannon and I disagreed. We felt that going public might help others with kids who have diabetes. You would not believe how many die every year from being misdiagnosed. So if any flu-like symptoms persist, do not hesitate to get a blood test as we did. The fact that our son was diagnosed while I was on the biggest stage of my career was no accident. It was the very stage we could use to save lives. The organization back home was unbelievable. They arranged for a private jet to take us to Boston the next day, and they made sure we met with doctors at the Joslin Center, the top diabetes research facility in the world. The concern the Celtics showed was something Shannon and I will never forget. And oh, by the way, there was still Game 6 of the NBA Finals, the next biggest game of my life, to be played. Some wondered once word got around if I would play. I certainly would, and mostly that was due to the amazing help we got for Walker. He was feeling good enough to sit on Shannon's lap during the entire game. Every time I looked over, I was reminded of how grateful I was that he wasn't taken from us. So here we are, the game. We traded baskets for the first quarter, and for the first 5 minutes or so of the second, until we made our move. A three by James Posey, a three by Eddie House, two free throws by Eddie, another three by James. The lead was suddenly 14 points, and by the half, 23. Nonetheless, we didn't get ahead of ourselves. We came back from 20 down in their building, so there was no reason to think they couldn't come back from 20 down in ours. As usual, the key to maintaining a lead like that is to tell yourself the game is tied. It's not easy, human nature being what it is. The first shot you miss, we used to always say, is the first pass to the other team's fast break. Whatever we told ourselves, it worked. After three quarters, we were up by 29. Now we just had to wait for the horn to let it all out. The final, Celtics 131, Lakers 92. There would be another banner, number 17, to hang with the others. My emotions were all over the place that night, and for days to come. Too much had happened in the last year, in the last week, for them not to be. I felt totally vindicated. After each season before, I'd watched other teams play for a title and felt unworthy, like I had cheated the ownership and the city I played for. They were paying me an obscene amount of money, but what precisely was I giving them in return? Not a championship. Not even a trip to the finals. Now, at last, I could sit home, think of the owners, and say, I did what you brought me here to do. In Game 6, I hit 7 of the 9 threes I took to finish with 26 points. I finally had an answer for the fans as well. Every summer I would hear the same question. What happened to you guys this year? Wait until next year, I would tell them, and believe me, I got sick of saying it. I didn't leave the garden until about 4 in the morning. At one point, Paul, KG, and I sat together in the locker room, no other players around. I don't recall what we said, but I recall how we felt. All those years of losing, and now this. And yet, as the days wore on, there was a part of me that felt empty, and it wasn't because Walker getting sick proved how little basketball meant compared to real life. I knew that already. It had more to do with having always believed that when you win a championship, you're transported to some new exalted place. What I realized was that you are the same person you were before, and that if you are not content with who you are, a championship or any accomplishment isn't going to change that. My favorite part of winning the title wasn't hugging my teammates or watching the fans celebrate. It was standing on the podium with Walker in my arms. His eyes were red. He was tired. He had been through so much for someone so young, so little. But I knew he would be fine, and that we would take care of him. A few days later, we went on the duck boat, this time as a championship team. I was blown away at how many people turned out to revel in the moment. Up in the high-rises and down in the alleys, in block after block. They were everywhere. I thought back to the ride in October when it was just Doc, Paul, Kevin, and myself. Going like this one, from one neighborhood to the next, with nothing more than a dream. 13. So close and yet. With Paul, our captain, leading the way, we pulled the ropes, sliding the banner into the place it would occupy forever. Another opening night in Boston Garden, another chance to celebrate. The fans had been waiting 22 years for the next banner to go up, and now that it had happened and another season was here, the question was, could we do it again? It would be an even tougher task than winning it the first time, and that's true in every sport. The other team studying your blueprint for success tried to copy you. Then there's the challenge of how to manage your own expectations as individuals and as a team. They're not the same as they were before. Michael Jordan put it best when I ran into him that summer. You guys got lucky, he told me. Winning one is lucky. Winning two, now you would be doing something. I felt a little uncomfortable discussing the subject with MJ. I wasn't in his league. He had 6 championships. I had 1. Still, I listened. How could I not? The major problem you're going to have to worry about is your role players not wanting to play their roles anymore, Michael went on. They go home after the season and everybody tells them how great they are, and it goes to their heads. They come back and want more minutes and more shots. Only time would tell if that would happen to us. Speaking of roles, I took on a new one myself that summer, the role of husband. Shannon and I were vacationing on July 4th on Martha's Vineyard when the idea of getting married occurred to us. A month later, in front of about 40 friends and family, we said our vows. I fell in love that night at the All-Star Cafe in New York, and the love was deeper than ever. On opening night, we picked up our rings, sprinkled with diamonds and emeralds, and got back to work, knocking off Cleveland 90-85. We did it without James Posey, who had signed a 4-year contract with the New Orleans Hornets for $25 million. James would now have 2 rings to show his teammates. Losing James, who could hit the 3 besides playing great defense, was a big blow, but we still had our core and a strong bench, as we saw on opening night when Leon Poe scored 13 points and Tony Allen added 11. In mid-November, after a rare setback at home, to Denver, We went on a tear and didn't lose again until Christmas Day to the Lakers in Los Angeles, the streak ending at 19, the longest in franchise history. We were 27-3, the same record we had at this point in 2007. Maybe Michael was wrong. He wasn't. Rondo, Perk, and Glenn Big Baby Davis, a backup forward, demanded larger roles. There was absolutely nothing wrong with that, in my opinion. You want to have players with ambition. KG Paul and I had our max contracts and all-star game appearances. Far be it from us to tell them they shouldn't go after the same rewards. Only having a larger role should happen naturally in the flow of the offense, along with the same willingness to sacrifice that got us a title. If on a given night, depending on the matchups, that means fewer shots or less playing time, so be it. Take Big Baby, who wanted more touches. When he got the ball, he often took shots before we were able to develop any kind of rhythm, and Doc had to sit him down. Perk also wanted more touches, and I tried to accommodate him. Too much, apparently. Stop throwing the ball to Perk, Doc told me. As for Rondo, he was becoming one heck of a point guard, although he too was seeking a more prominent role, altering the dynamic that worked so well for us in 2008. So even though we were 41-9 in early February, on another streak at 12 wins and counting, I didn't have quite the same feeling about the direction we were heading in as I had the year before. No Ubuntu in this group. Too often we had conversations reminding guys to move the ball around instead of looking out for themselves. The final extra pass in each possession, no one did it better than the Spurs, is usually the one that gives you the best look at the basket. The pass we weren't making. Then 2 weeks later it happened, what I feared most in 2008. In a game against the Utah Jazz, Kevin hurt his leg going for an alley-oop. He had to sit out a few weeks. We hoped he'd be ready for the playoffs, but the grimace on his face whenever I saw him was not a very encouraging sign. We would have to defend our title without him. Defending the title began in earnest in a first-round matchup against the Bulls. You couldn't have asked for more suspense. Four of the games went to overtime, including an unbelievable Game 6 in Chicago. Up 3-2, we were looking to close them out. I could not have played any better that night, scoring 29 points in the first half, more than the rest of the team combined. Nonetheless, we were trailing 59-57. I went through a difficult stretch in the third quarter, but in the fourth, scored 9 points in a 21-2 run that helped us rally from a 12-point deficit. I hit a 17-footer with about 2 minutes left to put us up by 5, though the Bulls staged a comeback of their own to tie it at 101. We called time. 29 seconds to go. Doc drew up a play for Paul. In other circumstances, I would have had no problem with the call, since Paul was a sensational one-on-one player. I had a problem this time. As hot as I was, I would finish with 51 points. I was the most logical choice to take the final shot. Paul, conversely, was struggling. He would end up 5 of 13. We tried to get him going, but it was just one of those nights. Whatever I was thinking, I kept my mouth shut. Remember when Scottie Pippen sat out the last 2 seconds of a playoff game in 1994? After Phil Jackson called for Tony Kukoc to take the final shot? Michael was playing baseball at the time. Taking himself out of the game is part of Scottie's legacy, and he has to live with it. Kukoc, by the way, hit the shot as the Bulls beat the Knicks. Unfortunately, there was no happy ending for us. Paul missed, and we lost in triple overtime, 128-127. I'm not saying I would have made the shot. You can never say that. Only that I liked my chances. That loss hurt, and with one more, we'd be done. Yet having been in this position the season before on 2 occasions and survived, we believed in ourselves and came through again by defeating the Bulls in Game 7, 109-99. Eddie House went 5-for-5, including 4 threes. On to the conference semifinals against the Orlando Magic. That was where not having KG was a killer. Big Baby tried his best, He even won a game for us, game four, hitting a jump shot at the buzzer to square the series. But he wasn't KG. He couldn't rotate over quickly enough to cover Hedo Turkoglu and Rashard Lewis, my former teammate in Seattle, on the perimeter. He and Turkoglu couldn't miss, and we never knew where the next shot was coming from. In that series, by the way, their players did something I had never seen before. While they were in the layup line prior to tip-off, they danced and held a dunk contest. In the playoffs! They're taking this as a joke, I told the guys. Joking around or not, the Magic blew us out in Game 7 at the Garden. So much for defending our title. I don't like to make excuses, but I can't help but feel that if KG had been 100%, we would have come out of the East and met the Lakers, the eventual champions, in the finals again. Man, that would have been fun. Then, in 2009-10, came a season to remember, and an ending to forget. We started out strong once again. 6 in a row. 20 of 24. 27 of 37. KG was his old self, while Rondo made plays at both ends of the court you don't see other point guards make. Even so, we went through some tough times beginning in mid-January. During one stretch, we dropped 6 of 8. Doc, as usual, found a way to motivate us. We were in the locker room at Staples, having just beaten the Lakers 87-86, although there was no reason to get overly excited. Kobe didn't play. "Guys, we're going to be back here," Doc told us, meaning the finals. "I want each of you to give me $100, and we'll come back in June to collect." Everyone contributed, including players, coaches, and team managers, bringing the total to a couple thousand. Doc put the cash in an envelope, got up on a chair, and hid it under one of the ceiling tiles. "Obviously, you can't tell anyone," he said. I thought it was brilliant. Coaching is about more than drawing up X's and O's and making the correct substitutions. Coaching is about having a certain mindset, an unwillingness to surrender, and getting your players to fully buy in. And now that we had invested in ourselves, we had to follow through. A few weeks later, at a hotel ballroom in Cleveland, he was even more emphatic. "This thing is doable," Doc said, showing us the schedule for the rest of the season. "Who in this conference can beat us? Which one of these teams you afraid of?" No one said a word. He went on. "We're not going to get home court advantage, so we'll have to win on somebody's floor to get a championship. Tell me if anyone else in this room believes it's not doable." Again, not a word. When Doc was finished, the guys were ready to storm the Bastille. In the first round, we took care of the Heat in 5 games. So far, so good. Then came LeBron and the Cavaliers, the number one seed in the East. Most people didn't give us a chance. Cleveland had won 61 games that season, 11 more than we did. The Cavs took Game 1, 101-93. But thanks to 19 assists from Rondo, we squared the series in Game 2, only to give home court right back when they beat us at the Garden by 29. That must have woken us up, as we captured the next 3 to win it in 6. The Magic were next. We got revenge for 2009, that series ending in 6 as well. Doc was right. This was doable. Only one test remained. The Lakers. It promised to be quite a series. When we arrived at Staples, there was something we needed to pick up before practice started. The money hidden in the ceiling, of course. Doc shut the door. "Everyone gather around," he said. "We're back here just like we said we were going to be." He stood on a chair, retrieved the envelope, and handed us our money. Now it was time to go after the real prize. For me, Games 2 and 3 will always stand out, for vastly different reasons. We needed Game 2 badly. In Game 1, the Lakers had defeated us 102-89. Kobe, the star, with 30 points, 7 rebounds, and 6 assists. Unless we took the next one, we'd fall behind 2-0, a deficit we hadn't faced in a playoff series in 2008 or 2009. I was feeling pretty optimistic, being used to having good games against the Lakers and against the Western Conference teams in general. The bigs in the West didn't defend the pick and rolls the way the bigs in the East did. They stayed in the paint. When I came off a pick, I would usually get a clean look at the basket. A shooter can't ask for anything more, except obviously for the shots to fall in. Which was what happened in Game 2. I hit 8 of 11 threes in a 103-94 victory. Back to Boston we went. Win the three games there, and we hang another banner. One that, a few months before, no one could have seen coming. First, we had to win Game 3. We didn't, and that was on me. The numbers were ugly enough. 0 for 13, 8 of which were threes. But it was my approach heading into the game that set me back. I figured the Lakers would defend me the way they defended me in Game 2. They didn't. Every time I came off a screen, somebody was in my face. They weren't going to let me go off for 30 again. "Stay on Allen," Phil Jackson kept urging his guys. "Don't let him get open." I should have done what I learned from George Karl and let the game come to me. Don't rush your shot. Try one from mid-range. Give them a pump fake and drive into the lane. Get someone else a look. Anything but keep launching threes. Anything to take the Lakers out of their game plan and force them to adjust again. We lost 91-84, and L.A. was now up 2-1. Even so, I didn't get down on myself. You can't allow the lows to be too low or the highs too high in this game, or, pardon the pun, you'll become a basket case. Anyway, we bounced back to take Game 4, 96-89. Big Baby with 18 points off the bench. We went on to capture Game 5, 92-86, despite 38 from Kobe. Going back to Los Angeles, I felt very good about our chances of winning Game 6 and another championship, until I saw Paul. During our walkthrough at the hotel, he was leaning against the wall and was not as dialed in as he should have been. I wasn't the only one who noticed. "Paul, pay attention," Doc said. "I need you here." That night, Paul scored 13 points and turned the ball over 5 times. To be fair, none of us were as dialed in as we should have been. The result? Lakers 89, Celtics 67. There was more sobering news. Perk injured his knee in the first quarter and didn't return. He would soon be declared out for Game 7. So here we were, right where we were destined to be. One game to decide it all. In the hours leading up to the game, I prepared like I always did. I got my shots up and the proper rest, and tuned out any distractions. Doc, for a change, didn't say anything to motivate us, and he shouldn't have had to. If you're not motivated for the single most important game of the series, of the season, well, that's on you. We got off to a strong start, leading 23-14 after the first quarter. The lead was 6 at halftime. Then, beginning the third quarter, we went on a 9-2 run to go ahead 49-36. In a low-scoring game such as this, each possession a struggle, 13 points was a big advantage. By the end of the quarter, however, it was 4. Kobe wasn't having one of his better nights. He would end up 6-for-24. But Ron Artest, the Lakers' small forward, was all over the place, scoring baskets, making steals, firing up his teammates and the fans. With 6.5 minutes to go, I hit 2 free throws to put us on top 64-61. It would be our last lead of the night. Lakers 83, Celtics 79. After congratulating the Lakers, I couldn't get to the locker room quickly enough. I wasn't going to stick around and watch them celebrate. Once everyone was together, Doc got our attention. "You had a great year, guys," he said. "You can hold your heads high." He then told us to form a circle one last time. Forming a circle is a big deal in basketball, as I'm sure you've noticed with other teams. With us, Doc used to say, "Everybody come in and touch someone." One player, and it was usually KG, stood in the middle and said a few inspiring words. The message was unmistakable. We are a team, and no one person is more important than another. This was one circle I shall never forget. Rasheed Wallace, the ex-Pistons forward we signed as a free agent before the season, who was one of the toughest guys in the league, was in tears. "You guys were great," Rasheed said. "I appreciate everything that you did. I'm glad I could go on this journey with you." Although he had a year left on his contract, he told us right then he was retiring. He had nothing left to give. I knew how he felt. I went dark for the next week, or it might have been 2 weeks. I wasn't keeping track. I sat by myself in a room at our home in Boston and did nothing but watch TV. I wasn't interested in going anywhere or talking to anyone about Game 7 or any game. You'd think I would have had a broader perspective by this point, after what Shannon and I went through with Walker, and after realizing that winning a championship doesn't change who you are. But it is still quite an accomplishment, and it had been in our grasp until it was gone. Our window was closing, especially once LeBron took his talents to South Beach and teamed up with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh to form a big three of their own. They were now the talk of the NBA. Only our window was not closed yet. In the 2010-11 season, we took 23 of our first 27, including 14 straight before losing to the Magic 87-78 on Christmas Day. We still had our core from 2008 and had replaced Rasheed with another vet with championship experience, Shaquille O'Neal. In early February, we went to meet the Bobcats in Charlotte, where I would have a chance to break the record for most three-pointers held by Reggie Miller with 2,560. I was only three behind. To be honest, I felt uneasy with the attention I was getting from the media. Basketball is a team sport. I never set out to break any records, this one included. It was too late. The record would soon be mine, and that being the case, I wanted to break it in Boston, not Charlotte. So that night against the Bobcats, I'm not proud to admit this, I made sure not to break the record. On several possessions, when I was open for a three, I took my sweet time, came in a couple of steps, and opted for a two instead. I attempted only 2 3-pointers the entire game, nailing both, leaving me one back of Reggie. A few nights later at home against the Lakers, I hit a three late in the first quarter to set the new mark. Speaking of Reggie, he was doing the color commentary for TNT that night, and after breaking the record, I went over to give him a hug. In Denver 2 weeks later, I was standing near the free throw line next to Birdman. You know, Chris Anderson, the tall white dude with the colorful tattoos all over his body. "Man, I watched the game the other night. That was cool," he said, referring to me passing Reggie. What Chris said really affected me. As a player, you become so wrapped up in your own world, you forget that the other players in the league are fans too. One thing I didn't lose sight of was my relationship with Rajon Rondo. It had been pretty bad for some time. Back in 2009, when I was told the two of us might be traded to the Phoenix Suns, I called to let him know the word was that he and Danny Ainge didn't get along, and that was why there was talk of a deal. "You need to meet with Danny," I told Rondo, "to iron out any issues you guys might have." I don't know if he ever did speak to Danny, but as it turned out, the deal wasn't made. Later on, though, Rondo brought the matter up again during a team meeting. He brought up a lot of things. "I carried all of you to the championship in 2008, he blurted out. The rest of the team, almost in unison, responded, "You what?" "Each one of you had issues with me," Rondo went on. "None of us had issues with you," I chimed in. "You did too," he said, looking directly at me. "You told me I was the reason we were going to be traded." "I never said that, Rondo. I was just telling you what I heard." On and on it went, and nothing that I said or anyone said got through to him. He believed what he wanted to believe. There was no question about Rondo's talent. His ability to be a leader was a whole other issue. Leaders work hard day after day, not just on days when 15,000 people happen to be watching. Leaders also don't put their own stats ahead of the team. There were times when Rondo would pass up a sure layup in order to pick up an assist. That was the record he was going for. "Dude, lay it up," I would tell him. "You're just trying to pad your assists total." Doc noticed what was happening and tried to find a solution. One day in 2010 or 2011, he asked KG Paul and me to come to his office. He got right to the point. "You guys have to let him into the circle," he said. "You have to give him a voice." KG and I couldn't have disagreed more. "We can't make him a leader," I told Doc. "He has to earn it." The days of being Rondo's mentor were long gone. I had become his enemy at some point, and I would be his enemy for the rest of my days in Boston. That had never been my intention, as it wasn't with George Karl or anyone I didn't get along with. And even if I wasn't the best of friends with another player, he was still my teammate, and I wanted to do whatever I could to help him. That included Rajon Rondo. He had problems from the line, hitting less than 60%. Most games are lost by 8 points or fewer, and teams miss about 10 free throws a game. If Rondo could raise his percentage to, say, 75%, even 70, that could be a huge boost for us. One day before practice, I saw my opportunity. "Let's shoot some free throws together," I suggested. Rondo didn't say a word, but the look on his face said enough. "I don't need your help." I walked away and never offered to work with him again. I can't help somebody who doesn't want to help himself. Frankly, it made no sense to me. Here was a chance to get advice from one of the better free throw shooters in the game. How can you not take it? In 2011, during our playoff series against the Heat, we saw Rondo's anger like never before. We were at practice the day after losing Game 2 in Miami to fall behind 2-0. Yet Doc, it should come as no surprise, was as upbeat as ever. "I want you guys to watch this film," he said. "We're not that far from what we need to do. We did a few things to beat ourselves." He proceeded to show us what they were. The layups we missed, the defenders we didn't box out, the switches we didn't make. One clip showed Rondo failing to get back on defense. "Rondo, look at your body language," Doc said. Rondo didn't say a word and stopped looking at the screen. He put his head down and turned his chair toward the lockers. "Bro, watch the film," Doc said. "Fuck that film," Rondo said, as he stood up and threw a water bottle that cracked the screen. The rest of us got up too, thinking Rondo was going to charge Doc. That's how much of a rage he was in. "Get him out of here," Doc said. Rondo took off, KG right behind him. Practice done for the day. KG, you had to figure, being the no-nonsense team-first guy he was going to tell him to wise up. Whenever somebody kidded around too much on the bench or in the locker room, he'd set him straight, such as one of the times Rondo came to a shoot-around with his shoes untied, the laces out, his hands in his pants. "Young fella," KG said, "you need to get your shit together." He didn't tell Rondo off this time, just the opposite. "Youngin, you're going to be all right," he said. If KG wouldn't keep him in line, we were in trouble, because Paul certainly wouldn't get involved. "I'm just going to do my time," he used to say. Nor did Doc really try, though there were occasions besides the incident at practice when it looked like the two were about to trade blows. One evening, I was in my hotel room when I got a call from Doc. "Let's go to dinner," he said. It wound up being Doc, KG, and myself. Paul was invited too, but didn't come for some reason. "We can't win with Rondo. He's not a good dude," Doc told us. "I spoke to the ownership and they're on board for him to be traded." KG didn't defend him. He knew Rondo had to go. He didn't go. The trade discussed would have sent Rondo to the New Orleans Hornets for their exceptional point guard, Chris Paul. But in the end, Doc decided he couldn't do that to their coach, Monty Williams. Doc was a mentor to Monty, having coached him in Orlando. So imagine my reaction in the fall of 2011 when I found out Doc was planning to build the offense around Rondo. Since they could not trade him, the thinking was they might as well find a way to make this work. That season, my last under contract, was the most stressful by far. It got to the point that Rondo would not even throw the ball to me. I would be wide open coming off a screen, and he'd go in another direction. "What's up with your boy?" my friends asked me. Not wanting to start any rumors, I'd respond, "Oh, he sees something better." Behind the scenes, however, I complained to Doc. "Yeah, me and the coaches talked about it," he said. "We've got to figure out something to do." His idea was to bring me off the bench for Rondo, so that I would play alongside another guard, Avery Bradley, who was in his second season. "You'll get more touches," Doc said. Why, I wondered, didn't he just tell Rondo what he expected from him? Wasn't that his job? "Trust me," Doc used to say all the time. "I know what I'm doing. I've been a part of the NBA for more than 25 years. Doc, I've been in the NBA almost half of my life, too," I finally said to him once. "Just because you say this is how it's supposed to be done, doesn't mean it's the only way." Now, you can see why the Celtics might want to get rid of me. And at one point, it looked like they had done just that. The call came from Danny right before the deadline in early March. "Ray, you have been traded to Memphis for O.J. Mayo, their young shooting guard." I called home right away. Shannon, as usual, took the news in stride. If I had been dealt to the moon, she would have said, "No problem," and gone to look for her astronaut suit. I never took trades well, as you know. For once, at least, I didn't hear the news first from the media. It didn't matter. Danny soon called back to say the deal was off. I never did find out what happened. Nonetheless, as long as I was still in Boston, I was determined to make the most of it. The season did not start until Christmas Day because of another owner lockout and was reduced to 66 games. It was a struggle the first 3 months. In one stretch, we lost 7 of 8. Not until late March did we begin to play well, winning 7 of 8, including a victory over LeBron and the Heat, to put us at 30-22. About a week later, we beat the Pacers on the road. You would think as a unit that we were bonding at just the right time. Far from it, I'm afraid. In Indiana, Paul and Brandon Bass, our other starting forward, were arguing with each other the entire game. I don't recall what started it. Only that Paul was speaking to Brandon as if he were some kid, not a grown man. "Talk to me with respect," Brandon kept insisting. When I walked into the locker room after the game was over, they were still at it, and it looked like they were about to throw punches.
"Guys, what about Ubuntu?" Doc said.
"Man, we ain't been Ubuntu in here all year," Rondo said.
"What are you talking about?" Doc responded.
Then Rondo out of nowhere brought my name up. I had been sitting there, icing my feet, trying to stay out of it. So much for that idea.
"What the hell are you talking about?" I said as I leaped up.
"You're jealous of me," Rondo went on.
"Jealous of you? For what?"
"You need to stop bullshitting everyone on the team," I told him, "and play every night instead of when you choose to play."
The two of us were now screaming at each other, Rondo acting as if he thought he were the GM, as well as the point guard.
"I'm going to get your ass out of here this summer," he vowed.
"Dude, I'm going to be gone before you have any say-so. I'm out of here."
That was the end of it. Until we were on the plane to Boston. I got out of my seat and approached Rondo, who had been chatting with Doc. I still felt that Rondo and I, as two adults, could resolve this. And with just 3 weeks to go before the playoffs started, we needed to.
"What makes you think I'm jealous of you?" I asked him.
"I'm good," he said.
"What do you mean you're good?"
"I got 11 games to play with you, and that's it."
There was no point in saying another word. Whatever was between Rondo and me could not be resolved. Somehow we won 8 of those 11 games to finish 39-27. Setting up a first-round playoff series against the Hawks. We lost Game 1 in Atlanta, 83-74, as Josh Smith had 22 points and 18 rebounds, but that wasn't what disturbed me the most about that day. With 41 seconds to go, Rondo was signaled for a technical after the official called a foul on Brandon. No big deal. We were trailing by 4 at that point,
and would have needed quite a rally to pull it out. But then Rondo bumped the official, Mark Davis, with his chest. Huge deal. The NBA would take a close look and decide whether to suspend him. Having missed the game due to an injury, I did an interview on the court for a few minutes afterward, and then went to the locker room. The guys were talking about the bump. "Shorty," Paul told Rondo, "you don't need to say anything to the media. Just get dressed and get on the bus." KG agreed with Paul. "He has to say something," I told them. "He has to own up to what he did." Paul and KG didn't buy it for a second. I appealed to Rondo for practical reasons, if nothing else. "Tell them your adrenaline was going and you didn't mean to bump him," I said. "You're already suspended. The question is for how long. If you walk out, it shows no respect, that you don't give a damn." He didn't buy it either. I wasn't surprised. He had never apologized, after all, for breaking the TV screen, and that was an important practice for us. I approached Doc next. "You need him to speak to the media, or we're going to lose him for more than two games," I said. Doc agreed, and Rondo gave in. Fortunately, Rondo, as it turned out, was suspended only for game two, which we won anyway to square the series. We took the next two in Boston and closed the Hawks out in six. Next was a date with the Philadelphia 76ers, who extended us to seven games. In game seven, Rondo was the hero with 18 points, 10 assists, and 10 rebounds. When he played like that, we could beat anyone. And we would need him to play like that, as we'd be taking on LeBron James and the Heat in the Eastern Conference Finals. We weren't intimidated, that's for sure. Dropping the first two games in Miami didn't lessen our confidence one bit. In game two, as a matter of fact, we were up 11 in the third quarter before LeBron and D-Wade went off. Even then, we staged a comeback of our own to force overtime. Check out Rondo's line. 44 points, 10 assists, 8 rebounds. By the way, he played the entire 53 minutes. Sure enough, we won the next three, including game five in Miami, 94-90 to grab a 3-2 lead. One more, and we were going back to the finals. In game six, however, LeBron poured in 45 as the Heat beat us by 19 at the Garden. What I recall most about that night were people chanting, "Let's go Celtics," as the game was about to end. They were doing whatever they could to get us geared up for the next game, game seven in Miami. Like I said, you won't find better fans anywhere. We were geared up all right. The game tied at 73 heading into the fourth quarter. But the Heat pulled away to win, 101-88. Yet as disappointed as we were, there was nothing to be ashamed of. No, the shame came after the game. In the final seconds, I reminded the guys to congratulate Miami and wish them well in the finals against Oklahoma City. You've seen it many times, the players hugging their opponents afterward like boxers after a fight. You didn't see it this time. Not from all my teammates. "Screw those motherfuckers," one guy said, and he was not the only player who felt that way. "I'm not shaking anybody's hand." I tried to talk them out of it, but they kept walking away. We were no different from the Pistons team who, about to be swept by the Bulls in the 1991 playoffs, headed to the locker room before game four was over. That will always be a part of their legacy as much as the titles they won. And now I was afraid that failing to congratulate the Heat would be a part of ours. You find out a lot about an individual, or a team, in victory. You find out a lot more in defeat. The Heat went on to beat the Thunder in five games for its first title with LeBron. Their future was as promising as ever. Our future wasn't. We had delayed the inevitable for a while, but couldn't delay it any further. When the clock struck midnight on Sunday, July 1st, for the second time in my career, I became a free agent. The phone rang at 12:01. It was someone from the Memphis Grizzlies. This was going to be an interesting couple of weeks. 14. The final move. The plan was to stay in Boston. There was no place like it. I knew it the first day in July 2007, when my family and I arrived from Seattle for the press conference at the Garden. One look at the practice facility and I thought, now this is a franchise. To stay, however, I'd need to believe that the organization respected me. In a few weeks, I'd turn 37, old in NBA years. Earlier in my career, I figured to play about 12 years. That would be all my body could handle. I was at 16 years and counting, so as long as the team did right by me, I would be back. Except the Celtics were in no hurry to get anything done. My agent kept reaching out to Danny, but he was put off each time as the team focused on coming to terms with everybody else. That included a player who wasn't even on the roster, free agent guard Jason Terry. Finally, when they got around to me, their offer was $12 million for 2 years, far less than what I deserved, based on what other players around the league with my skill set were earning. I had asked for $24 million over 3 years, a sizable pay cut from the $10 million per season I'd been making, and $3 million less, incidentally, than Steve Nash would get the very next day from the Lakers. And he was a year older than me. But the Celtics wouldn't move an inch from $12 million. I'm sorry, Ray, but this is all we can give you, Danny said. Of course, a contract is usually about more than money, and this was no exception. I wanted some assurance of the role I'd have going forward. I had been gradually phased out of the offense and feared it would only get worse. Instead of throwing the ball to me or to Paul in the final seconds of a quarter, Rondo would dribble forever and then launch a desperate three. Our efficiency at the end of quarters was horrible, and Danny knew it. I wish I could say you weren't telling the truth, he said. I asked him to find out if there was reason to believe anything would be different next season. I'll take it to Doc, he told me, and see what he has to say. It didn't take long to get an answer. Doc said nothing is going to change, Danny told me. The offense is going to go through Rondo, and you need to be on board with it and win on this team's terms. If you're not, then you need to choose elsewhere. So let me see if I got this straight. You want to pay me less money. You want to bring me off the bench. You want to continue to run the offense around Rondo. Now tell me again why exactly I would want to sign this contract. I got off the phone and texted KG. It's not looking like I'm going to be back with the team, I wrote. Danny's not giving me the money. Nah, it's going to be all right, he texted back. They're going to take care of you. No, he's not. KG and I could have gone back and forth for hours, but there was no point. I knew what I knew, and since the Celtics were not going to take care of me, I realized my years in Boston were probably over. Yet it took a call from my sister Kim to convince me to give up any last ray of hope. You've made enough money in your career, she told me. They're not respecting you. You haven't been happy for a long time. You've got to leave. Kim was right. I needed to explore other options, which I was fortunate to have. Miami was one. I would listen to what they had to say, but I had my doubts, still hurt from losing to them in the playoffs. Minnesota was another. How ironic to be pursued by the team that drafted me in 1996 and then got rid of me 30 minutes later. Memphis, where I nearly went before the trade deadline, was also very interested, as it proved with the 12:01 a.m. call. The team I was most intrigued by was the Los Angeles Clippers, with their talented core of Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, and DeAndre Jordan. I made plans to stop in L.A. after first meeting with the Heat representatives in Miami. The Clippers were worried, however, that I was using them to get a better deal somewhere else, so I reached out to their coach, Vinny Del Negro. My ties in Boston are being severed, I assured him. I've been treated unfairly. I'm not using you guys for leverage. I'm trying to figure out the next place to go. I don't know whether he believed me or not, but while in Miami, I found out the Clippers reached an agreement with another shooting guard, Jamal Crawford. So much for going there. It was now down to Miami, Memphis, and Minnesota. The Heat offered $6 million over 2 years, even less than Boston, while the Grizzlies and Timberwolves could propose no more than the $5 million per season mid-level exception. If this process were to go on for much longer, I'd be playing for free. In the end, I chose Miami, and for one simple reason. The Heat afforded me the best chance to win a championship. Memphis had made the playoffs the last 2 years, but failed to get past the second round, while Minnesota had not been in the postseason since 2004. I knew fans in New England wouldn't be happy with my decision, but I never could have imagined the degree of unhappiness. They acted as if I was Benedict Arnold, and they weren't alone. "Am I wrong," a player from another team tweeted, "for thinking Ray Allen is a traitor for signing with his rival team, the Heat?" Yes, he was, but it did not matter what I thought. Once he put it out there, others picked up on the same theme. The criticism was unfair, and let me explain why. First, Boston and Miami were not rivals. So the Heat beat the Celtics 2 straight years in the playoffs? You need more than 2 years to establish a rivalry. Secondly, it wasn't as if I was going for more money. I was taking less money. My sin was that I had the nerve to leave on my own. Some of the people, as a matter of fact, who had wanted me out in the past were now the same ones furious with me for going. A cable TV station in town had done a poll a couple of years earlier, asking fans which player should be traded. Care to guess who received the most votes? I called the head of the station to complain. "Why are you doing this?" I asked. "My family is watching. They're very hurt by this." In any case, I felt then and still feel today that I have nothing to apologize for. Okay, that's not entirely true. I regret not calling Paul before the news became official. I owed him that much after everything we had been through the past 5 years. Unlike KG, who knew how frustrated I was over my talks with Danny, Paul was totally in the dark. In my defense, however, things happen so fast when you're a free agent and trying to decide on your future. A lot was made over KG refusing to shake my hand a few months later when we opened the season against the Celtics in Miami. Others near the bench shook my hand and wished me well. Doc gave me a hug. Kevin acted as if I didn't exist. Was I hurt? How could I not be? Was I shocked? Absolutely not. KG would quarrel with his grandmother if she signed with another team. Perhaps it was too soon, the emotions too raw. I hope one day we have that talk we should have had at the steakhouse. I will never forget what he said to me my first year in the league, his second. Our teams were playing each other in the preseason. "Can you believe it? Look where we are." Now I was going south, to another franchise, hoping to hold on to that feeling of awe and gratitude. Before this career I loved came to an end. I arrived in Miami a battered dog, as I like to put it, from those last 2 seasons in Boston. I found it hard to believe I wasn't still there, fighting the same losing battles. My new teammates helped me get past all that, with the respect they showed me and one another. You almost wouldn't know that these guys had won it the year before. The role players didn't show up at camp expecting more touches, more minutes, more everything. Veterans such as Shane Battier, Mike Miller, and James Jones were in the gym by the time I got there. Mike and James got up more shots than I did, and no one ever got up more shots than I did. The tone, no surprise, was set by LeBron. I was impressed by his talent, but more by his desire to learn from others. He didn't assume he knew everything. Plenty of great players do, which keeps them from ever being greater. Shooting free throws was a perfect example. LeBron had his troubles from the line, and he'd be the first to admit it. "We need to shoot free throws," he said to me one day. "I need you to tell me what I'm doing." I was glad somebody wanted my help. That had not always been the case in recent years. "You want to focus from the start," I told him, "to get your percentage as high as you can. When you miss a few, you'll still be in the 80s, not the 70s. Get down in the 70s, and it's hard to claw your way back." I got him to work on a new routine, but when he missed a few, he would drift back to his old routine where he kept the basketball to one side of his body, before letting it go. "Don't worry," I told LeBron. "You can put the perfect stroke on a ball and have the perfect form and still miss. Now you just got to go and get the next one." I was also impressed.